This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories. Every other week, we'll bring you a feature called Women Who Dare. It's from New York Times bestselling author Gail Sheehy. A profile, women who dare, what they dare to do, and why they dare to do it. If you have a daring story or know one about someone else, please share it with us at SheeheyDaringProject.com. SheeheyDaringProject.com. For this inaugural feature, Gail brings us the story of a journalist who dares to give a voice to the Syrian rebels in their fight for their future against two mortal enemies, ISIS and Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad. Here's Gail.
Today's daring woman is a beautiful blonde 20-something American woman from Boise, Idaho. When she first started reporting from the Middle East in 2011, Anna Day stuck out like a daisy in the desert. But she stuck it out from day one of the Arab Spring in Egypt to the chaos in Syria today, 5 years later.
I realized, you know, instead of being frustrated that I'm often undermined because of my age and my youth, that I needed to really turn that into an asset. Mm-hmm. And the Arab Spring was the perfect climate to do that because, you know, I was interviewing my peers. The Middle East, 70% of the Middle East is under 30.
Wow, perfect.
So I got to, you know, interview and interact with them in a very different way because I was their peer.
Anna, what made you drop everything and fly into Cairo?
I had a lot of Egyptian activist friends who I had met while studying Arabic in college. When Tunisia fell to a revolution, they called me and they said, "Get down here, Egypt is next." I didn't think in a million years it would happen. I saw the conditions under which they had been organizing for years. It was very dangerous to be an activist there. But I said if I were to miss a revolution in Egypt, I would never forgive myself.
What was it like in the middle of Tahrir Square?
The first day of these protests that were called, I woke up and the blogs and a lot of the internet had been shut off by the government. Then I started walking towards Tahrir Square, and it was flanked with rows of police officers at every road that leads into the square.
A very clear sign.
As I reached the square, I heard a kind of chorus of protesters coming. And as I approached the square, they approached it from the other side, and I entered the square the minute they broke into the square and broke that police front line.
Wow.
For the first time.
So you were right on the spot. And how did you let news organizations know that you were there?
I got a million pictures from that moment. I knew I was in the middle of something really special. I saw women, young people, people who were Muslim and Christian of all backgrounds protesting. So I got those pictures, and that night I put them online saying, "The revolution has begun."
From Cairo, you began making a circuit of Middle East revolutions. You went from reporting in Egypt to Bahrain to the Libyan war. And then why Syria in 2011?
I met activists from Syria who had come to Egypt to learn about revolutions, and they started telling me about the kind of horror that was going on in their country and the lack of journalists. So these young people encouraged me and other journalists to come early on. So when these war reporters died inside Syria, many of the Western news organizations decided to pull out.
And that was the beginning of an almost complete shutdown of Western journalism in Syria. What was your impression of the war in your first year of covering Syria? Was it just another civil war like Iraq seemed to be in the beginning?
For me, I had never seen anything like it. One of my first experiences in Aleppo was in a hospital. I was inside doing an interview with doctors. One of those first barrel bomb attacks happened in Aleppo, and a stream of people started coming in. Women, children of all backgrounds coming in maimed, and I froze. I really didn't know how to handle that situation.
Never been in it before.
Never been
it's
in it
It's a total
before.
Shock the first time.
Yeah, and I really froze. I didn't know to just continue photographing the streams of people coming in that were maimed.
Maimed.
And while in that moment where I froze, the hospital started getting shelled. By the fall of 2012, I felt I had seen enough war crimes that this war couldn't possibly continue into 2013.
The UN would stop it. America would stop it.
Mm-hmm.
The world, sane world, would stop it.
And now it's 2015. Yeah, young man said to me, I said, okay, listen, like, you have a gun now. Now you're a combatant. You're not the nonviolent protester. And he said, first of all, this is armed resistance. We're defending ourselves. They're bombing our schools and our hospitals and our homes. And he said, and secondly, this is our American Revolution. You guys defended yourselves from tyranny with guns, and we're fighting for our right to vote.
The fact that you were a woman, how did that work with Arab men?
A lot of them are very shy because they have a more conservative society. Mm-hmm. And some of them have been very protective. I've had Syrian rebels make sure I had my separate sleeping quarters, and they locked me in a closet in this little compound that they were defending, and they said, we feel so bad, but this is your free Syrian hotel. Welcome. And they did bring me strawberries the next day, saying, we wish we could bring you more than this.
You got an amazing scoop in 2013. The Daily Beast published it with this headline, Dining with Al-Qaeda. They didn't even realize they had an even bigger scoop.
I sat down with a group of foreign fighters who were part of a group called ISIS.
Your publisher didn't recognize ISIS and changed the headline, called it Al-Qaeda, right?
Yes. And, you know, a year later, obviously, that would have been the leading headline. And at the time, it just sounded like I was, you know, too into the weeds of this story, making distinctions between these rebel groups. Mm-hmm. But inside Syria, that distinction had become incredibly important. And ISIS at that moment, not Al-Qaeda, had the momentum.
What did these guys tell you was their motivation?
So they were fighting a war of defense in many ways. They came to defend the women and children that I also saw being bombed, but they were doing it for a different end game than the Syrian people. The Syrian people were fighting for the right to the vote, while these foreign fighters are fighting for the reestablishment of the caliphate.
And they were eventually, it didn't take them very long to be fighting on both sides of the border of Syria and Iraq.
Yes.
And establishing the beginning of their caliphate.
Yes, that summer there were major developments on both sides of the border of Iraq and Syria, both because of the Islamic State. At the time in the West, we were still reporting on these two countries as separate theaters, and they were talking about developments in Iraq separately from developments in Syria. But the big point at that moment was these developments were coming with a very deliberate organization from one specific group.
What is your hope now that Russia is bombing to buck up the Assad terrorist regime? We don't know who's fighting whom. All we do know for sure is that the Obama administration has finally stopped, killed the Pentagon plan to train and arm Syrian rebels. A couple months ago, they found out their $50 million effort had provided only 5 rebels who didn't run away when there was an attack against them. So they've disbanded it. So we've walked away from the fight.
There's not a lot of points of opportunity in Syria, but there still are a few. And if the U.S. politically cannot get involved in a military capacity at this point, there's certainly a way to be involved in terms of absorbing refugees, in terms of supporting our allies in the region who do support refugees, our allies in Turkey and Jordan and Lebanon. So I think the U.S. has failed to lead in the civilian realm, but on a military realm, The people of Syria only asked for weapons after a no-fly zone was denied to them. So from their perspective, it was very logical. If you won't defend us from the jets that are bombing our elementary schools, then let us defend ourselves. Give us some guns. Give us some anti-aircraft missiles and artillery to do something, to defend ourselves.
What kind of daring does this chaos reporting take?
Well, it would be a day-by-day risk assessment to make sure that, you know, we're keeping our team safe and the Syrians that work with us on the inside, but also, honoring this story. We've seen so many of our colleagues die for this story. We've seen so many civilians live through this horror, and again, we see Assad emboldened by the lack of coverage and the lack of accountability. So a lot of journalists are committed to keeping this story in the headlines and, you know, conveying it in, with the urgency that it will take to hopefully ignite some kind of policy change.
A very brave young American from Boise, Idaho, who's been risking her life for 5 years to keep reporting on this terribly sad part of the world. Thank you, Anna Therese Day.
Thanks, Gil.
This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and that was New York Times bestselling author Gail Sheehy's feature, Women Who Dare. After the break, Gail will join us live to dive deeper into the story of Anna Therese Day. This is Lee Habib, and you're listening to Our American Stories. That's Paul Simon, and he was born today, so throughout the show, we'll be playing some of Paul's greatest work. And my goodness, what a catalog he has. What a great American writer. And joining us now, the aforementioned Gail Sheehy, and you can see and report, and you can actually join Gail's project, which is a terrific project. SheehyDaringProject.com is where you can go to learn more and to just join this regular weekly segment that we're going to be doing here on Our American Stories on daring women. Gail, thanks for joining us.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here.
And thanks for the report. You know, Gail, you know, the other day we did a story from the Wall Street Journal on a woman who had joined the Kurds and was fighting. She had joined the Peshmerga. She didn't want to be called a female Peshmerga. She ended up becoming a sniper, and ISIS ended up killing her. And I feel the same way about this incredible young woman. Tell us about her life, Gail, her parents. Let's start at the beginning.
Well, here she was, a Midwestern girl. She grew up with parents who were activists, and very young, she was taught the difference between charity and social justice. But she had tragedy in her life. Both of her parents died before she was 12 years old, so she had to become independent early.
And her choice of journalism, do you think that came from that activism and her following in the footsteps of her parents, Gail?
Well, I think so, but she asked a teacher in college what should she study to equip herself to be a journalist, and the teacher said, study language. You must learn a foreign language, and then, you know, something for context, like history or political science. So Anna took political science, and then she made off to the Middle East and got a place in Tel Aviv and studied Arabic in Jordan, in Lebanon, and in Egypt. So when the first Egyptian revolution happened, she was primed to be there as a really intelligent spokesperson.
Right, and what better tool to have in your toolkit, Gail, than to understand what people are talking about while you're there?
So many of our even Foreign Service officers don't have language or cultural training.
No, it's stunning to me, and I, as you know from the last name, Habib, to not know Arabic and not know Farsi and go into these places and not know the people and the tribal nature of the people there. It's not just that they're less nationalistic than they are tribal, and they have their ways and they have their mores and they have their religion and there are splits within the religion. You know, Christopher Hitchens once told me most of the reporters here wouldn't know a Sunni from Shia, and it's true. Let's go back to the interview. What does Anna's family think about seeing a young family member put herself in, well, in such great danger, Gail?
She never asked for permission, and if she had to, she'd apologize later. But she never told them where she was going next until she came back out.
You know, it's interesting that so often I find, even with men in the military, the dads didn't want him to go. I remember right after 9/11, I think we had actually been talking on the Dennis Prager show, Gail, and a caller had called in, and he had told his dad basically that he was signing up, and the dad was like, well, maybe you need to rethink this, and he said, sorry, Dad, see you later. And I think that courage sometimes comes from unspoken places, Gail, and then they don't talk about it; they just go and do it. How did Anna get in and out of Syria, Gail? How did she do that?
Well, imagine, I'm here. She is a petite, blonde American woman who happens to be beautiful, And early on, she was invited by Syrian rebels, and they'd set up meeting points over Facebook because they were all very fluent in social media. They were the same age. And then the custom officers, where she crossed from Turkey into Syria, would say, "Do you understand what's going on over there?" She'd just walk right through and cross into a no-man's land on the Syrian side, heavily mined, and then continue on foot until she would see a sign, "Welcome to Free Syria." And what was that? It was a no-man's land guarded by kids with guns, 16 and 17-year-olds. And here she was, a high-value target for kidnapping and ransom. But at first, she'd stay with rebels' families in the countryside. And then as those people either were killed or fled the country, she'd be protected by one of the militias that hoped always to be backed by the U.S. But by 2014, this is 2 years after she started, she was worried about them because they were skin and bones, and she had to bring them food. And the only way they could keep her safe, as you heard in the earlier interview, was to lock her in a closet on their compound, along with her Arab photographer. And they called the closet Hotel Free Syria.
And, you know, in your full interview, Gail, with Anna, you talked about the remarkable level of civil society the rebels had built up in the areas they controlled before ISIS came in and destroyed it all. Tell us about that, those pockets of civility and civil society that she had witnessed.
Well, it's still happening in the northeastern part of the country. They were rebuilding their schools, setting up post offices, even divorce courts, and talking about how they were going to separate military and civilian rule in their country. And when she told them, "Hey, you're not peaceful protesters anymore, now you carry guns, you're combatants," they said, "You had to use guns to defend your revolution. We're fighting our American revolution."
You bet, you bet. In another part of your full interview, Gail, and we're talking, by the way, with Gail Sheehy, best-selling author. You know her work in Vanity Fair. And we're going to be joining Gail regularly to talk about women who dare and daring women. And my goodness, Gail, I don't know how we top this one. This is beyond daring. Tell me about the part of Anna's interview, which we'll post on the website, by the way, the rest of it, in which she talks about how she strangely related more to the ISIS fighters than the Syrian rebels.
Yes.
In some odd senses. Tell us about that.
She interviewed foreign fighters who were being recruited by ISIS, and because many of them had been educated in the West, either in the United States or Canada, they'd watched Western movies. They'd make the same cultural references. They knew about the Smurfs. And this wasn't the case with Syrian rebels, who came from a much more conservative background. But these foreign fighters with ISIS ingratiated themselves with the Syrian people by saying they'd come to help them protect their homes. That sounded good, right?
Yep.
They're recruited to be married off to Syrian women from powerful families in town and village after town and village so they can spy for ISIS. And then they're able to turn families against families, divide and subjugate the population. And this is all copied from the model of the infamous Stasi intelligence organization that subjugated East Germany.
You bet. I was about to say that. A good friend of mine had lived there, family had lived there, and said, "You just don't know what it's like. You don't know what's up and what's down. The Stasi were at every corner. They were inside every family. You didn't know who was good and who was bad." And it was sort of reverse, double agent spies. The courage here, Gail, is remarkable. What do you see in Anna's future? And what do we have, do you think, coming up in the horizon with us, Gail, as we go along in this daring project together?
Well, for Anna, she's going back in with yet another film crew as soon as she can, and to report on the refugee crisis on the border of Syria, and then to sneak into Syria when they see an opportunity. Of course, they're going with no protection and with actually no assignment. All the news organizations are just on hold, and they hope they'll come out with a documentary that will turn up on our television sets.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And Gail, next week we'll be joining each week you with a variety of stories. And there's all kinds of daring in this world, Gail. It's always so hard. I have Marine friends, and I've done some courageous things in my life. And you don't want to compare your personal courage to courage like that. This is a bar that is almost impossible to match. But we look forward to the partnership here, Gail. Folks who are listening, SheheDaringProject.com. That's SheheDaringProject.com. Gail Sheehy, thanks so much for joining us.